This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow at the Sheldon Concert Hall in St. Louis. How many of you are regular listeners to the show on Friday? Thank you. If you're a regular listener, you know that one of my favorite topics is the microbiome, right? All that stuff that's living in your gut, all the bacteria and the viruses and things like that. It's one of my favorite topics, and we tend to focus on the human microbiome. We're a navel-gazing species, right? We like to look at our, literally. In fact, there are studies that have looked specifically and exclusively at the microbiome in your belly button. It's true, and they have found, guess how many types of bacteria they have found there on the average? Any guess? 5, 10, 100, close? 67. 67 different types of bacteria living in there, and they change all the time, and we pass them around to one another, things like that. Well, tonight, I know it's kind of interesting to think about. Tonight, we're going to leave your belly button behind a little bit and investigate another incredibly important microbial habitat, and that is the soil. There's a microbiome in the soil right down below our feet, and we're going to learn to get your hands dirty in this one. Bo Aduapong is a microbe hunter of sorts. She's a PhD student in ecology, evolution, and population biology at Washington University in St. Louis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
So we talk about what's living in our belly button all the time. What's living in the soil?
So we have these microbes that are able to kind of decompose different materials in the soil. So decomposition is one of the fundamental ecosystem processes. It's fundamental because it's able to kind of recycle the materials on this planet Earth. Without them, we would have dead bodies kind of just lying all over the ground.
I hate when that happens, you know, it's. And so turning dead material back into soil is a big function of the microbiome.
Yes. So if we think about decomposition and we think about some of the biogeochemical cycles, one important cycle that decomposition is really important in is the carbon cycle. So carbon first binds to oxygen in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide, and then plants use carbon dioxide to react with water in order to make oxygen and sugars, which is super important for us, of course. In order for us to live here on this planet, we need oxygen. But also the sugars that are made by the plants are kept in the plant cells and used in order to make their cell walls. What's really important there is that as consumers, we actually eat the plants, and therefore this carbon is again transferred from plants into consumers. And then when we die, again, because of decomposers, they come and save the day, essentially. They come in and help break down those organic molecules into inorganic molecules, into carbon dioxide, and then that gets recycled back into the atmosphere.
Yeah, and then the plants take it back up again.
Exactly.
To make more stuff out of it.
Make more stuff.
Now, I talked about we have a microbiome in us, and you're talking about the microbiome that's in the soil. Do the plants, the trees have, you know, their own microbiome living in them?
Yes. So if we think about the root system of plants, we think about them as an inverted gut. So our guts are inside of our bodies, but for plants, their roots are inside of the soil. And so what we've discovered and what I study in my lab is I'm really interested in the bacteria that actually live inside of the roots of plants. So most people look at the bacteria that are inside of the roots on the rhizosphere, and most of the time they study these bacteria that can break down nitrogen. So nitrogen kind of forms these bonds with each other, and they form these really strong nitrogen bonds, three of them. And so these decomposers are able to break down the nitrogen bonds and allow ammonia to exist for the plants to use up again. However, I'm really interested in the bacteria that are inside of the roots, because why are they there? So it could be used for the immunity of the plant, so to help make sure that other pathogens, other bacteria or fungal that could hurt the plants, don't invade that system.
That's just sort of like in people.
Yes,
too.
Exactly.
Our defense system uses all those microbes in our gut and our intestines to fight off diseases. You know, you don't normally think about a plant having an internal disease or a defense mechanism.
Yes, right? So plants do have an immune system just like humans, but what's different for plants is because, of course, they don't move around. they're having to have cells all around their plant tissue in order to recognize bacteria. So they're able to do it in a very different way from humans because we have these human cells that are able to kind of travel around our body and find things that are foreign to us. But for plants, they have to have that type of function within every single one of their cells.
Wow. Yeah, they're not moving very quickly, are they?
No.
And now I understand that one of the things that you have studied in the past was something that actually eats the soil bacteria.
Yes. So what decomposes bacteria, right?
You need a balance.
You need a balance.
You've got to have a balance.
Exactly. So what I studied during my undergraduate degree was Dictyostelium discoideum. So it's a social...
What was that?
Dictyostelium discoideum.
There will be a test at the end of this.
So it's a really cool organism, and this is one of the reasons why I really became a scientist. So I stumbled upon a discussion section in my undergraduate campus, and they were going over life cycles, and I said, whoa, what is this organism? So what happens is they first start out as single cells. So they are eukaryotes, and they're found in the protozoa family. So what happens is that these single cells eat bacteria, and then when they start to starve, when there's no more bacteria around, what happens is they send these signals to one another called cyclic AMP. So they say, hey guys, we're all hungry here. We should go somewhere else. So they all gather together and they form slugs. So again, they start out as single cells, and then they come together to form this slug. And then they will travel a little bit, like centimeters, not very far. and then they will form a fruiting body. So what they do is this slug transform into a stalk, and then they have a sorus, which is on the top of the stalk. What's really cool about this organism is that 80% of the slug of those cells will die in order to form that stalk. And then 20%, so only 20% of them will live on in the sorus. And so in the sorus, you can find spores that are developed there, and that's essentially the next progeny for the next generation.
Now, I promised the audience that we'd have a hands-on, get-yourself-dirty experiment that we could perform. Tell us what we can do.
Yeah, so I'm part of the Young Scientist Program at Washington University. And what we are a group of graduate students that kind of go around and do science experiments with K-12 students around St. Louis. So we work with public schools, we work with private schools, we work with anyone who wants us. And essentially, we do all these different fun activities, and we range all the way from ecology, which is what I do, all the way to anatomy and physiology. So we have all these different demonstrations. So one demonstration or a demo that we did with the students just this past week at Vashon High School, where these students are actually part of this project called the Show Me Costa Rica Project, where they will be able to take an 8-day excursion to Costa Rica. But
can I get in on that project?
Yeah.
Get on 8 days of Costa Rica.
It is. But essentially, we don't want them to just think of it as a fun field trip, right? We want to teach them about biology. So again, we were talking about the biogeochemical cycles, and we wanted to kind of teach them how the cycles can happen in a fun and interactive way. So we made these Winogradsky columns. So what I did was I went to a pond out in Forest Park, and collected soil there, and then we basically took the soil and put them in these columns. You mix the bottom half of the column, or about a third of the column, with paper, egg yolk, and also chalk. And so these will serve as a substrate for the microbes to feed on. And then you pound the rest of the soil on the top and leave a little bit of water at the top of the column. And so what happens is, once when you close this column, it becomes a closed biogeochemical cycle. And what will happen is you'll see the stratifications within the column. So you'll have oxygen being more rich at the top of the column and oxygen being very poor at the bottom. And this creates basically bacteria that are able to live off of oxygen, so aerobic bacteria, will live at the top, while you'll have anaerobes, bacteria that can only live in the absence of oxygen, living at the bottom.
So you sort of have a layer cake.
A layering cake.
And what's the strata? What's living where?
The aerobic bacteria, so the bacteria that can live in the presence of oxygen, will be at the top, and the bacteria that can only live in the absence of oxygen will be living at the bottom.
And kids are doing this.
And kids are doing this.
Are they interested? Do they light up when you do this?
Oh, they loved it. One side note is that you will need to have a lot of paper napkins around and also hand sanitizer, because at first we had gloves there. As you can see, the students had gloves. And then they said, oh, whatever, it's soil. We can just grab it and go on our ways. And so they just loved the activity, and they found it really exciting.
That is kind of cool. Let's step up close to the mic, please, and ask you a question.
Yes. So you were talking about microbials inside the actual plant. Can your research eventually lead to a point where we could have a new type of fungicide or insecticide that can protect our plants, our crops, and things, either at home or just in large-scale farms?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. So as a graduate student, that is something that I want to do next, as maybe during my postdoc or working with some industry. So part of my research is about is looking at the microbes that are inside of the root and kind of translating that to what the plant growth. So trying to understand, if you have a certain microbial community in your root, do you grow faster? Do you grow more? Do you have more biomass just because you have a certain community structure there? And so that could also lead to, all right, is this microbial community stable? Is it stable over time? So if you were to perturb that microbial community with a pathogen, does it stay the same? So it's essentially in ecology the stability hypothesis. And we try to understand, is that community stable even in the presence of a pathogen? And if it is, then we know that that pathogen can't get into the community. If it's unstable, then we know that that pathogen can perturb the microbial community, and then there will be things in flux. And so that's kind of the things that I really want to study as my next steps. So.
If only you had a biochemical company located in this city. Nah, never going to happen, I don't think. Thank you, Bo. Thank you for taking time with us. Bo Aduapong is a PhD student in ecology, evolution, and population biology at Washington University. Thank you. And playing us to the break, Buckley and Walsh. This is Science Friday from PRI. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the Sheldon Concert Hall in St. Louis, Missouri. Yes, St. Louis is home to the Missouri Botanical Garden. If you haven't been there, it's great. Isn't it a great spot? And as part of its vast collection, the garden houses more than 24 species of endangered plants to further its conservation mission. But conserving a species takes more than keeping specimens alive. You need to know how they're doing in the wild, what kinds of populations and subspecies they're sorted into, and how much biodiversity is available for breeding future generations. My next guest extracts DNA from ground-up leaves to determine whether endangered plants are as threatened as they seem, and how to make most of a small gene pool. She even works in captive breeding programs for plants. I didn't know they even had captive breeding for plants. And she's here to explain how tiny repeated sections of genetic material can drive some of the biggest conservation decisions. Christy Edwards is an assistant scientist in conservation genetics at the Missouri Botanical Garden Center for Conservation and Sustainable Development. She's also an adjunct professor of biology at the University of Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You know, there's a show on TV where you sit between two ferns and get interviewed. We're like two nerds in front of
a plant between two nerds.
Tell us why that plant is here. What is important about that? What is that plant?
Okay, so this is a Dracaena umbraculifera, or actually what we thought was Dracaena umbraculifera. This is a cutting of a huge tree. And what we figured out was this species was listed as extinct in the wild. And so that's really remarkable in a lot of ways. And so we did some work, and we looked at all these botanical gardens around the world, and we found that there's 18 specimens around the world.
So you did genetic analysis. of the plant?
Yeah, so what we did is we extracted DNA, and so of this plant, we got specimens from all around the world, you know, from Russia, from France, and we also got some specimens from the island of Mauritius, where the plant was supposed to be from, also some specimens from Madagascar, where, you know, just kind of in that general Indian Ocean region.
Right.
And we looked at their evolutionary relationships, and what we found was that this plant actually turned out to be more closely related to plants in Madagascar than Mauritius.
Wow.
So we went to Madagascar. We have this big research program in Madagascar, and this plant that was supposed to be extinct in the wild actually turned out to be living. There's about 200 plants living on the small island off the coast of Madagascar. So.
Wow. How do you do genetic analysis of a plant? Do you have to grind up the leaves? And how do you do that?
Yeah, so essentially what we do is we'll take a sample of a leaf and we'll put it in silica gel to dry it. And that inhibits any DNAs or RNAs. These are enzymes that break down DNA. And then we will grind it up into a fine powder. We'll add some detergent, which further breaks down the cell walls of the plant and releases the DNA into a solution. And then we just purify the DNA, and we end up with a small tube with, you know, 100 microliters of DNA that we will use to genotype it. And then we'll take that DNA and we'll further break it down into smaller pieces. I use a process called next-generation DNA sequencing, where you end up with millions of DNA sequences, and then you kind of assemble them back together. And a lot of work.
So.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
So what do you do after you've gotten this genetic information? Now what do you do with that info?
Well, so basically what we do is we are kind of interested in understanding more about diversity, right? So so if you think about diversity, there's three different levels that biologists recognize. There's ecosystem diversity, species diversity, and genetic diversity. And in terms of what we're interested in kind of understanding kind of relationships among species, and then also genetic diversity. And this is important because you really need to know what you have in order to conserve it.
We have a question from the audience. Step right up to the mic. Close, please.
So who's going to save bananas?
That's a very good question.
That is a good
question.
Yeah, very good question.
Explain why that's such an important question.
Well, so bananas are essentially, they're all one large clone. So
every banana we buy in the store is a clone of another banana. There's only one species of banana that we're eating.
Well, so there's different varieties, right? And most of those are all clonal. But bananas are triploid, which essentially means that they have three copies of chromosomes. And what that also means is that they're unable to reproduce sexually. And so there's really no new material being produced in bananas. And so the thing is there are quite a few people who are working on, like, crop wild relatives. Actually, one of my colleagues is here today who does that kind of stuff. And so they're looking at, you know, what is present kind of in the wild, like, relatives, and then they'll do some crosses to try to develop new varieties.
Yeah, because if we had a disease now, we would wipe out.
Yeah,
just
that's a major
concern.
Every banana
on the planet, or
yeah.
At least that we get in the store. Have you ever turned up a plant more endangered than you thought was endangered in the first place?
Yeah, so there's a species actually I've been working on recently. It's called the Missouri bladder pod, or Ficeria filiformis. So this species actually is in southeastern Missouri in northern Arkansas. And when we were going out to look for this plant, you know, it's known from 60 sites, and kind of the premise was when we received funding to work on this project was they were going to delist it. You know, they just needed to know it was doing good, and they were going to delist it. They thought it was fine. But then when we went out to the populations, you know, every time we'd go out to try to find it, this is a species that loves disturbances, so it really likes to be burned. And a lot of the endangered species that I work with are fire-adapted species.
In other words, to keep them growing, you have to burn away.
Yeah, you have to burn away all the competitors.
You have to allow fires to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, most of them don't like to have, like, brush over shading them. So, you know, we would go out and we'd find, you know, like, half the populations were gone because they hadn't been managed. And then the ones that we went to go find, there was, you know, populations hanging on. And then, you know, we took them back to the lab. So we go out and collect DNA in each of the populations where we found the plants. And we collected DNA. And what we'll do is look at patterns of genetic structure. So essentially how genetic diversity is structured across the landscape. And in this species, what we found is that there's a lot of genetic structure. So genetic variation can be grouped into clusters. And we basically found that within, you know, 5 miles, you'd find a genetic group. And then the next 5 miles, you'd find another genetic group. But the problem is that in this species, there's only three or four major populations being protected. And we found like 15 genetic clusters. So only really a third of the genetic diversity in this species is being protected.
Well, are you buoyed by your work that you can go out and conserve species that are disappearing? Are you hopeful about this?
Well, you know, you can kind of, it depends on the species. You really kind of just never know what you're going to find when you're working on these things.
Yeah.
You know, like this one, I just thought it was going to be this easy project. Everything was fine. And
how young you are, I can tell. Well, that way. Yeah.
And then, you know, I got the results back, and it was actually really disheartening. But, you know, the Dracaena and Brachylifera, for instance, we went in thinking it was extinct in the wild, and then we find that there's several hundred individuals living there. So I mean, I guess the thing is, you just really never know what you're going to expect. You never know what you're going to find.
How many biologists, you know, or is this a common, your work, is this a common work by other biologists out there looking for endangered plants and how to conserve them?
There's a handful of us.
It's a handful.
Yeah. I mean, there's not, you know, they're not lurking behind every doorway.
No. Yeah. So you do remain, we have a question. Yes.
Hi. Your work is so interesting, and the fact that you are taking these plants and finding genetic variations that need protection. For those of us not as informed, mm-hmm. What kind of protection does getting on the endangered list get you if you're a plant?
Oh, well, you know, that's a good question. So for animals, actually, it gets a lot of protections. If you were to kill, like, an endangered animal species, you know, you can be prosecuted. But actually, for plants, essentially, if the plants are the property of the landowner, right? And so really, the main place where it provides protection is on federal lands. But the one good thing about being listed as federally endangered or federally threatened is that the Fish and Wildlife Service will develop what's called a recovery plan. And essentially, this is a list of goals that need to be completed in order for the species to be considered recovered. And usually, it's things like, you know, reducing habitat loss, making sure that a certain number of populations are protected and managed appropriately. And so a lot of times these are goals that really are make some sort of meaningful contribution to the conservation of the species.
Yeah.
Yes. So it does help. I guess the thing is that it's usually a very slow process. You know, recovering endangered species, you know, a lot of times things will be listed in the 80s and they're still on the list now. But there are a few success stories where they feel like they've recovered species enough to delist it.
Well, glad we have you as a handful of scientists, you know, helping to keep those species alive. Thank you very much, Dr. Edwards.
All right, thank you.
Kristi Edwards, conservation geneticist at the Missouri Botanical Garden Center for Conservation and Sustainable Development. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. That sound can only mean one thing. The Science Friday Science Club is back in session. Yes. And I've been talking about the theme for tonight. We're calling it Breaking It Down. Break It Down. And by strange coincidence, that's the theme of our latest Science Club project. And here to tell us about it, our Science Friday's education manager, Ariel Zitch, and our director, Charles Berquist, the founding members both of the Science Club. Big hand for them.
Howdy.
So tell us what about the Science Club for people who don't know what it is and what our project is.
Sure. So Science Club is Science Friday's attempt to get you to do something. And not just anything. We want you to do things that like engineers do and scientists do. We want you to get a taste for it. And the best way to do that is to do it yourself.
Talk about why is breaking down. We talked about the soil before. Why is breaking down so important to science?
Right. So things get broken down in the natural world all the time, right? We've already had a few biologists on today to talk about, like, the carbon cycle, the breaking things down, right? Breaking plant bits down so you can get at those at that genetic information, right? But there's a whole lot of other examples, too. Breaking things down is a really important way to understand stuff that's complex, right? It's the first thing you do if you want to reverse engineer something. If you want to, like, you know, break down a whole bunch of almost anything, you can ask a fungus to do it, right? That's a really important breaker downer.
Sometimes you want to break something down to because you've got a big mixture of stuff and you can't sort out what's in it. This is a process called chromatography. You can try this at home with some filter paper. Even the stuff that's in your coffee maker works just fine. And you can see that your orange marker is not pure orange. It's got other colors in there. And you wouldn't know that without being able to break it down into its component parts.
I'm Ira Plato. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So now that you've all got your glasses on that are provided by Google's Making in Science initiative, they're not those Google glasses, but a different kind of Google glasses for you. We want to thank the Midwest Recycling Center for lending us, they're not going to get a whole one back, and giving us these different things to break down.
Let's get this
thing going.
Okay, so open your envelopes if you've got one, or look upon your friend who's got one. Pull out your 3D printed save icon, or your keyboard, right? And go to town. I'm not going to tell you how to do this. Just kidding. I'm going to tell you how to do this. So I highly recommend taking your little metallic thing off, right? This is called a shutter. Ooh, listen to that. I can hear everybody's shutters getting popped off.
Sounds of things breaking. Isn't that
joyous? Yeah, yeah. And you might, if you're lucky, you might catch the spring that flies out of there if you don't have a spring. I hear people going to town. That's good. Get in there. Don't hold back.
Yeah, see if you can get that. Oh, we got the keyboard apart.
Hey,
oh,
we got some people with the keyboards. Nice.
What does the inside of the keyboard look like?
Yeah, we'll find out.
I have never seen such an excited audience before.
I know, it's like you're all like looking inside of the floppy disk for the
project.
First time.
You get permission to break something. It's amazing. Charles is looking for some folks to talk to down there.
Charles, what do you have over there?
Okay, so I am here with Aurelia, and she is opening up a keyboard.
Hey.
And she's going to tell us what she's finding in there.
I found the motherboard.
There's a motherboard. I see a circuit board in there.
What else do you see? I see where the keyboard would be. There are just little dots everywhere.
Little dots in there? Is that what I heard?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Did you find any, like, big old rubbery mat thing?
Yeah,
there's one. Hold it up if you got it. There's
hold
a couple keyboards in the back, too.
Hold up your pieces. Let's see what you got.
Yeah, I want to see those, like, floppy things that look like dead jellyfish. There you go.
Whoa. How can we share? How can everybody share what they're seeing?
Right, I'm sorry. So half the fun of learning is telling other people what you figured out is inside of a floppy disk, or what you figured out as you broke things down on your own. And as you go out and figure out what's inside of other things that you explore this week, next week, the week after, we actually want you to tell us about it. If you've got your phone with you right now and you're a tweeter or an Instagrammer, take a picture of whatever you found or what your neighbor found on the inside of this thing and tweet it with the hashtag #IBrokeItDown, right? Because you broke this thing down. You figured out something about it, right? You can also Instagram it with this if you're into that. You can actually go to our website.
Yeah, if you go to sciencefriday.com/scienceclub, you will find a nice form that will let you tell us all about what you're breaking down and what you found inside. And it's not just limited to what you're doing here tonight. We're just hoping that this is going to inspire you to go home and do something else, do something new, and over the course of the next month or so, tell us about whatever that other thing was. Maybe you're into linguistics. You can break down a text. Maybe you're into music. You can send us sample cuts with different tracks broken down.
And you can keep doing this. There's no time limit on how to
do
the
project. No, in fact, if you break down a pumpkin this weekend, send it to us.
Thanksgiving's coming up.
Thanksgiving,
if you
break down
that turkey.
Yeah, there's a lot of things inside of a turkey.
Save me a drumstick.
Yeah, exactly. Save your drumstick. Do everything safely. So, like, my teacher voice, I always taught like this. My teacher voice is to please be safe. So, well-ventilated area, protection as needed, nothing plugged in, kids, no electricity, please, no batteries. And make sure nothing's alive.
Yeah. Kids, please ask your parents before taking apart the DVR. You know,
Be safe. Ask permission.
Yeah, thank you. You know, this is something we like to say you can try at home.
Please do.
And we encourage you to do it. Thank you, Ariel. Yeah. Thank you, Charles.
Thank you.
Ariel Vick, our education manager at Director Charles Berquist, founding members of the Science Club. And as I say, you can find out more and participate at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub. And we have a hashtag on social media, hashtag I broke it down. Thanks again. Coming up, we're going to shake things up a bit with a geologist who studies earthquakes. But first, Walsh and Buckley, come on out. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the Sheldon Concert Hall in St. Louis, Missouri. St. Louis, as everybody knows, is located right in the Midwest, nearly in the center of the country, but things could have been different. There's an ancient fault line that could have split the continent. It could have created an ocean along your northern neighbors around present-day Minnesota and Wisconsin. My next guest is trying to uncover signs of this fractured geological past. He's part of a team creating a sort of a telescope to peer underground with an interesting set of tools. He's using earthquakes and gravity. And we're going to test one of these out in a little bit. And if you want to participate in our little experiment right now, I take out your smartphones, you can download an app to your smartphone called iSeismometer. We have both the iPhone and Android versions of this. We're going to do a little experiment with it later. So just let's move along with that. Michael Weissession is a professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University here in St. Louis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's a real honor to be on your show.
Tell us about this ancient fault line. Where is it? How do we know it exists? Why are you interested in it? I'll pick any one of those questions.
Absolutely. So, you know, geologically, people usually think that the action happens on the edges of the continents, right? If you want to find an earthquake in the United States, you go to San Francisco or Seattle or Alaska. But 1.1 billion years ago, this was the center of attention here, and there was a massive rift. It actually extended from Oklahoma all the way up to Canada and back down again through Illinois and Indiana. And at this time, this was the African Rift Valley of its age. The continent was splitting apart, and the crust was thinning. And something unusual happened, though. There seemed to have been a hot spot in the region, like what's causing all the volcanoes in Hawaii. It seems to be a rare combination of a splitting apart of a continent with a hot spot, and you released at this time 2 cubic million kilometers of lava.
Wow.
And this far dwarfs anything that we have seen in the last, tens of millions of years.
As I mentioned before, you use the earthquakes themselves and gravity to map the fault lines. There's a gravity map of the U.S. right there on the screen behind us. What areas have different gravity measurements from one to the other? How do we interpret what we're seeing?
So essentially, usually, in this map, places that are purple and the line in the center of the image here, that purple line represents a high gravity anomaly. That means, you know, you may not realize this, but the pull of gravity actually varies slightly as you move about Earth's surface. It's a result in changes in density of the rock underneath you. Now, normally when you cross a rift, like the African Rift Valley, your gravity is a little bit weaker because you've stretched and thinned the crust and you've filled it in with sediments, which are less dense. This scar is just the opposite. It's a gravity high. Gravity pulls you a little bit more, and it's because there are 20 kilometers deep of basaltic lava that filled in this rift. In fact, instead of the crust being thin, the crust is actually 20 kilometers thicker than normal because of this massive amount of lava that filled it
in. And the lava's got iron, rich in iron and things like that, that affect the magnetic fields and gravity, stuff like that.
Yes, when you have lava and then you have hot fluids that flow through often for millions of years, you do some interesting things. This actually is important for the history of our country because this is the largest reserves of pure copper anywhere in the world.
That's why it's there.
And it's these hot fluids flowing through the basaltic lava pulled out metals that don't like to fit in the crystal structure of rock very well. And this was, you know, the mines along here in Minnesota and Wisconsin really fed our industrial revolution, you know. And
it's like, well, you have the Iron Range in Minnesota, things like
that's where exactly
it comes. That's where all that stuff came from. So these gravity anomalies help to pinpoint what you're calling the mid-continental rift. I don't think we've ever heard it talked about that way.
Yeah, so St. Louis, you know, we have a different idea of a rift here, right? Because we have the real...
We're not taking political rift here. Right.
Okay. Yeah, it's not the Mason-Dixon line. It's the other direction. It's a north-south trending rift. And you know, we have earthquakes around here. And that's a result of the fact that there was another rift here 750 million years ago, the real foot rift, where the crust was also thinned. Only... it's actually a zone of weakness in the crust. So as stresses occur, you get earthquakes in places like New Madrid. This mid-continent rift is like a scar that's healed over with very thick scar tissue. It's actually stronger than the surrounding crust, so it has no earthquakes. We actually had the set of seismometers up here for 2 years. We recorded thousands and thousands of mine and quarry blasts. We recorded 12 earthquakes that were about a magnitude 1 in size, which is essentially nothing. So this region has no earthquakes because it's so healed over by the thick lava that filled it in.
Well, then now that you see the gravity part, how do you use the earthquakes? You mentioned that we've had earthquakes here. How do you use the earthquakes to fill in the rest of the picture?
So actually, we use earthquakes from other parts of the world. And you mentioned the seismometer. You know, we can't see through rock, right? This is a problem that geologists have had for centuries, right? I can point a telescope in the sky. I can see galaxies billions of light years away. I can't tell you what's a foot beneath the ground. But we can hear what's in the earth. You know, my wife's a veterinarian. She uses a stethoscope to hear what's inside an animal. I have a seismometer that I can use to hear what's inside the planet, and anything in the planet that makes noise, human-generated or Earth-generated, makes a sound. And so we listen to the earthquakes arriving from around the world coming up underneath our network of seismometers, and it allows us to make 3D images, much like a sonogram does.
And that's why I asked you to download the app, iSeismometer, because we're going to do a little seismic experiment right now, aren't we? Tell us what we're going to do.
Okay, so this is a typical seismogram. There's a lot going on here. First of all, there are three components because we live in a three-dimensional spatial universe. So there's up, down, left, right, and front and back. And if you look at the iSeismometer app, there are many good phone apps that have seismometers. I like this one in particular because it does give you all three components. And if you sort of shake it different directions, you can see different of the three seismograms actually vibrate. And I have a demonstration here using a program called Quake Catcher Network, which was designed to actually record people's laptops from around the world. There have been cases where earthquake has been recorded by essentially, you know, a majority of Starbucks in the country. You can upload your signal from your laptop to this centralized location. But what I have here is actually an accelerometer, a type of seismometer, that is plugged in through the USB port. And this is a great tool, by the way, for teachers. It's used in classrooms across the country. You can demonstrate how an earthquake operates. To give you a sense of the sensitivity, though, if I just stomp from here, Whoa. You can see totally swamped the signal there.
I even got it on my app registry. Right.
And I want to do a little bit of an experiment here. I would like everyone on the left side to stomp their feet at the same time. One, two, three, stomp.
Okay. Whoa.
Wow, that was pretty
good. Look at
that. All right, let's try the right side here. One, two, three, stomp. That's about the same size, maybe a little bigger. All right, now the central part. One, two, three, stomp.
Wow.
All right, that's big. Now, I don't know if this is going to work, but I want everyone in the balcony. All right, we'll see, because now the signal, the vibrations are going to have to come down through the walls. I don't know that this is going to work, but we'll give it a shot. One, two, three, stomp.
Whoa.
There it is. You caused the whole building to shake, and we recorded it up here on the seismometer. Now, the seismometers we use for our research are so sensitive, we record small earthquakes in New Zealand or Japan or anywhere around the world. And so that gives us the ears to the ground that we use to make three-dimensional images of what the Earth is made of. And that tells us how plate tectonics works and how the Earth is moving.
Did this group of sensors that you have around, did they reveal anything about the geology of the mid-continent rift?
What we noticed, and in this diagram on the left hand, you see the location of the seismometers. Our deployment of over 80 seismometers was timed with a project called EarthScope, which was a fabulous National Science Foundation project that involved moving an array of 400 seismometers slowly sweeping across the country over 10 years. And actually now it's been moved off to Alaska. And so we had a large number of seismometers, and the images on the right show the depth to the what's called the MOHO, which is actually named after Andrea Mohorovich. We can never pronounce his name, so we call it the MOHO. It's the boundary between the crust and the mantle. And this boundary is normally about 40 kilometers beneath continents, 40 to 45 kilometers. Beneath the mid-continent rift, we see that dropping down to more than 60 or 65 kilometers, more than 20 kilometers thicker than usual. And that's due to the unique history where as the crust rifted and thinned, lava began pouring in, which was heavy, and pushed, depressed it down, which left room for more lava to flow in. And by the time the process was entirely done, you have, as I said, more than 20 kilometers worth of lava.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Michael Weissessen about a clinic he's conducting in earthquakes and seismology and how to detect them. We have someone in the audience here, yes.
Fracking in Oklahoma, does it affect the crust that was built from the basalt lava?
The fracking in Oklahoma, what relationship does it have to the earthquake?
So yes, thank you for that question. It used to be that the earthquake capitals of the U.S. were California and Alaska. That is no longer the case. The earthquake center of the U.S. is in fact Oklahoma. It used to get one or two magnitude 3 earthquakes a year. It now gets over 1,000. And this is entirely due to the pumping of fracking fluids back into the ground. Now, interestingly, it's not the fracking process itself that generates the earthquakes, but it's taking these fracking fluids, which are often toxic and cannot be left at the surface, and pumped down deep about 5 kilometers. And in the process, it actually lowers the pressure across the fault. Hey, let me give you an example. Would you push your hands together lightly and now slide your right hand up? Okay, so just slide it up like this. Okay, that's an earthquake. And at the surface, it happens fairly easily. Now I want you to push as hard as you can across your two hands. Now try to slide your right hand up. Okay, you can't do it. That's deep in the ground. The pressure keeps the fault closed and prevents earthquakes from happening. Now pump some lubricant, sort of oily fluid in between your hands and that earthquake will happen.
Wow.
So it only happens where you have pre-existing faults. And so these are old faults. Again, the continent is more than 1 billion years old there. But the faults are generally not active. However, when you pump the fracking fluid in and you happen to hit a fault, you will then generate
sort of lubricating that spot.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, so when we had all these the fault line there, why aren't we now not on beachfront property? You know, like that would be in California or whatever.
Well, so that's a question that actually colleagues at Northwestern and University of Illinois have been working on. And it seems like right about this time, what is now the Amazon basin of South America, we called it at that point Amazonia, was sliding past the southern part of what is now the United States. And while it was sliding past, this is when the rifting across the Mid-Continent Rift occurred. As soon as it broke away and the ocean started opening there between, you know, North America and Amazonia, that relieved the stress that was pulling our rift apart, and our rifting stopped there. So if it hadn't been for South America, we would now be in two pieces. So we owe Brazil a great debt.
All right, thank you. We'll all keep that in mind. Thank you. Fascinating, Michael. Thank you very much for joining us. Michael Weissession, Professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. That's about all the time we have. There are certain people we'd like to thank. Tim Eby, Eli Chen, Phil Donato, Rachel Bolland, Tim Albert, and Paul Reuter. And all the great folks at St. Louis Public Radio. We also want to thank the Sheldon Concert Hall. It's a beautiful place for making this wonderful evening possible. We also want to thank Kevin Buckley, Ian Walsh, and Mo and Abdullah Graves. And we cannot forget our Science Friday staff. Charles Berquist, Rachel Bouton, Daniel Dana, Brandon Ector, Ella Fetter, Jennifer Fennick, Sochi Garcia, Sarah Goldfarb, Luke Gruskin, Katie Heiler, Christopher Intagliata, Jen Kwok, Julie Liebeck, Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Annie Nero, Daniel Peterschmidt, Christian Scotta, Christy Taylor, Chow Tu, and Ariel Zitch. Thank you all for allowing us to do this. In St. Louis, Missouri, I'm Ira Plato.